Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Langdon Moss on the show. Langdon is the host of a great new podcast called The Savage West, where he unravels the complex web of early Western expansion, taking listeners beyond the basic narrative to expose the raw realities of America's savage origins. What truths lie beneath the legends of violence, greed, hope, and courage? What do the history books get right? And what ideas, events, and people deserve reexamination? Through dynamic, unscripted episodes, Moss explores divergent perspectives to challenge what we thought we knew about our past, inviting listeners to question and re-examine the stories at the heart of American history. Langdon also worked as a research assistant for a past guest, Dean King, with his book on John Muir. It's always great to talk with someone working in a similar space as myself, and we get into so much in this podcast. And Langdon even has a few questions for me as well. Please enjoy our conversation. Langdon, how did you find your interest in Western history? Where did that come from? Because currently you don't live on the West Coast. You live in Virginia. So connect for us Western history and yourself.
Yeah. To tell the full story, it'd take a while. So I'll give you the spark notes. But right after college, I was trying to be a writer. And so I was trying to get new experiences. I'd grown up in a kind of a bubble in Richmond, Virginia. And so I was looking to get experiences that were outside of my comfort zone a bit for purposes of, you know, becoming a writer and kind of seeing the world from a perspective that was different than mine. And I was fortunate. And then I got a job searching Google on a ranch in the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming. So right on the Great Plains. And I'd never heard of the ranch before. I didn't know anyone who was going to be there. And I was the saloon manager. I got thrust into middle America. I'd never been to Wyoming before. I'd done a lot of backpacking and hiking. I was an Eagle Scout, but Virginia is very different than the Midwest, very different than the Rockies. The Shenandoahs are the oldest mountain range in the world, one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world, whereas the Rockies are newer, so more rugged and just more open land out there. So being the saloon manager, I was just experiencing all these people from different places that I'd never been to. I was 23, just out of college at the time, and different economic and social and geographic cultures, and hiking around that area and just learning about the history of the Bighorns, with the Southern Pass being just south of there. It was just so fascinating to me. And I was still aspiring to be a writer at that point. So I did some traveling and went out to Australia and then eventually landed in San Francisco. When you're in San Francisco, you get steeped in the history of San Francisco a bit because it's all around you. And it's a newer city too, comparably to the rest of the United States. I had a passing interest in it at that point. And then when I left San Francisco and went on this solo find yourself journey across the country, I wanted to see the country for myself from end to end. And then didn't really plan anything during that and would go back and research the places I'd been after that experience. That ended up taking me into some pretty remote and unique areas. Like, for instance, I drove through unintentionally the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and right by the Wounded Knee Massacre site. And I didn't even know I was entering an Indian reservation until I was in the middle of it, and then going back and researching afterwards and realizing, like, oh, okay, like, this is the site that ended this whole Indian Wars event. And I wanted to understand how the Pine Ridge Reservation came to be and how I ended up there. So it's a length story of how I got into it. I got connected with Dean King when I got back from that trip, who worked on the Guardians of the Valley book about John Muir with. And so tied everything together a little bit.
Yeah, that's a fantastic synopsis based on what we've talked about a little bit. And I want you to explain for us what working on a book as a research assistant looks like and what skills you took away from that, and what, if you could offer words of advice for maybe people that are considering writing a book. What's your experience as being a support?
Yeah, it was so fascinating to me because I'd been aspiring to write. I was writing a lot of fiction, but also travel, nonfiction and memoir. So I was trying to write a story about the ranch at the time. So I had a base of knowledge in terms of going back and retroactively looking at what had happened in the past and how it related to the present. the John Muir experience and working on that with Dean was great for me, just because when Dean and I met, he was just thinking about starting the John Muir project. And so he was working on another book. And so I was left to my own devices in terms of building out the initial outline for that. And that really, that more than anything, led me to the history of San Francisco. We were looking at the water sources for how the evolution of Hetch Hetchy and how that ended up being stolen from Yosemite. And so to understand that, I had to go back and look at the early gold rush history when you first had this influx of settlers coming in. And within 1 or 2 years, they had 50,000 new settlers come in. And when before, San Francisco had about 200 inhabitants of about 200 people. And California as a whole had around 5,000 Europeans there. And then within 2 to 3 years, it had 90,000. Seeing that and realizing the effect that might have on California, I became more curious and to dive deeper into that history. So that was my first splash into it. And it's been a fascination ever since, just going in to try to understand what this whole history was like, because it was so foreign to me coming from the East Coast. Our history of America always focused on the English and the colonies. We didn't really learn that much about the gold rush. And I feel like the period has been buried to most Americans just because it began with the Spanish, then evolved to the Mexicans. And so it wasn't a part of the United States until the Mexican-American War. I think because of that, for a long time, it was hidden from most Americans in terms of that being such an integral part of what makes us.
We'll dig into more. I want to ask you something about your traveling, though. I've had lots of discussions with people recently about whether you will understand a place more by traveling to it or reading about it. Where would you line up on that question, given that you've done a lot of traveling and reading about subjects like this?
I for sure have to have my hands in the dirt, so to speak. My interest in history is that connection that I can make to my own experiences. When I began to travel and see the United States firsthand, then that got me more interested in, you know, how these places came to be, why there's so much wide open spaces west of the Rockies versus east of the Rockies, and how these national parks came to be. And so for me, I have to have at least been there or have some connection to myself in some way. It doesn't necessarily mean I have to physically be there. Maybe one of my relatives had been there, somebody I knew had been there. There's some connection I can make so that it made sense for me.
Yeah, definitely when you're reading some of the journals and essays of John Muir, if you're in Yosemite, you can see what he's describing. It's a different experience than just reading him and trying to visualize in your head some of the vistas that he's looking at. I'm curious on the John Muir question, given the research and your involvement with it, do you think John Muir should be venerated in the way that he is, or do you think his history is more complex and he's much more of a complex character than people assume when they talk about him?
So I love this question because I've been thinking about this a lot. And I've read most of his journals and most of the works on him. And I spoke at the John Muir Symposium back in 2018 at the University of Pacific. And during that time, there was if you remember, the Sierra Club had that kind of reckoning, pulling down our monument, so to speak. And we had the Black Lives Matter movement in Richmond, which is where I'm from, where our literal monuments to the Civil War were being pulled down. And so there was this reckoning with John Muir because he'd written some things in his journals that some people took offense to. And perhaps rightfully, perhaps not. The way I read it when I first encountered those things in the journal, especially how he wrote about Native Americans in Yosemite, I related to the way you might prejudge a homeless person you see outside of a convenience store without really understanding their background and knowing where they came from. Just assuming the worst, assuming through their own doings, they came to these circumstances. And if you read Muir's journals, he's describing them very literally as a scientist that he was. And then afterwards, this is omitted in a lot of the accounts that describe John Muir's supposed racism, he writes that if I knew them more, perhaps I'd like them better. And then he became an advocate for the Native Americans later in life. This is in his earliest journals. And so I look at that period without judging Muir as harshly as the present does. It's really hard to judge the past because they lived in such a different culture and circumstances. That whole kind of fight against Muir was perpetuated by the head of the Sierra Club at the time. I viewed it as he was doing it as a means to take advantage of this movement that was going on to solicit donations. From reading all his journals, he didn't come across to me at all as someone who is naturally racist. He engaged with all these different cultures. Of course, anyone in the past is going to have complexities and circumstances that you can judge retroactively, but I didn't come across any that were cancel worthy, let's say.
Yeah, it seems, and I've been reflecting on this too and trying to understand, because there are certain things that we pick and choose to judge historical figures on. Let me just give an example. So like you have the ancient Greek physician Galen. He had certain understandings of how the body works, and we obviously know those are clearly wrong now. And I don't think there's any, at least physicians I imagine working today, that are board certified that are using the ancient Greek principles of medicine.
Right.
But
hopefully not.
Maybe if you go to certain places, there are still people that are racist today and subscribe to certain beliefs. And so I wonder if the canceling is less about them being wrong, because there's lots of things historical figures are wrong about, but it's the presence of those ideas today. And maybe, I don't know, we'll reach a point where certain things are no longer extant in such a way that we feel like we need to go and correct. But it's also just, like you said, it's hard because when you are raised in a culture where certain things are taken to be axioms, like you can't just, it's one thing to see it now. And I don't want to necessarily get into the debate about whether we should take stuff down. I think there are certain things that make sense to, but it does seem way more complicated than people assume it to be to go through and police history.
Yeah, I think people jump to conclusions really quickly, especially based off of like limited accounts you have of these people, or they're like the one snippet you read of them, or maybe somebody watches this one video where it's like a takedown video and that's all they have to go off of. And it's really hard to go in, and no one's really done like super deep research into John Muir, who can talk about him in this way that's read all his journals and understand who he was as a person from as much as anyone can from start to finish. And I think that happens a lot to different characters in the past, that some of them we naturally want to agree with this video for some purpose, I guess, to appeal to our tribe in a way, maybe from articulating this very well, but it's just a natural human inclination to jump to those judgments quickly. And one of the interesting things about history too, is when you go through a lot of these accounts, sometimes you find that the whole picture you might have of a certain historical event, even though so many things have been written about it, you'll find that all these accounts of this one event come from one person's perspective. And all these subsequent accounts that are written later are citing that one source. Then if you go back to that source and you really find out like, okay, who was this person? What was his perspective? Did he have a bias for one way of looking at this event versus another? Then sometimes you discover that the person who's being referenced in all these accounts didn't necessarily have an even point of view. Yeah, it's really complicated to judge the past, and I try not to. And in the podcast and in any of these books, I try to look at as many perspectives as I can. And
that's just not our job, right? Our job is to clearly describe what happened in such a way where you're balancing the perspectives of the event, and then let people come to their own judgments after the fact. I think when I read writers that want to assign judgment in the midst of the historical monograph, in some situations I understand, but then other situations, I think the audience or the reader will arrive at the same conclusions if you describe them accurately. And if you don't feel like they'll arrive at those conclusions, then you have to give them those conclusions, then perhaps we need to discuss why you're doing the activity to begin with. But anyway, this is a whole sidebar. Yeah. Let's jump into your podcast. Yeah. So when you're doing the research for your podcast, were there any historians or writers of Western history that you fell in love with?
I really enjoyed David Roberts' take on the West. He wrote this book called A Newer World, which reevaluates Fremont's rise to notoriety and Kit Carson. And he looks at a lot of different perspectives and looks in detail about their journey west. And so I really enjoyed that account. Bancroft's account, I think even though it was written so long ago, and Herbert Hal Bancroft being the kind of godfather of Western history, with a team wrote these enormous accounts of not only California, but New Mexico, Arizona, all the Western states. Even now, looking at his accounts, it seems to be written pretty fairly in an unbiased way. Of course, he made some mistakes, and there are some things in there that he didn't have access to at the time, some historical accounts. He interviewed a lot of the guys who were a part of the gold rush and a part of Mexican California, and were the main players in a lot of these events that I'm discussing. in the podcast, and we'll be discussing in books, hopefully, in the not too distant future. Yeah, Band Across the Count, I really enjoyed. And then there were like, I went to a lot of different sources, but a lot of them were articles. And so it was scattered about.
No, I think the Bancroft stuff is underrated. Like a lot of the things we were just discussing, he has some outdated ideas. And we actually did a podcast a while ago where we discussed his wife's lack of representation and getting credit for a lot of the research that was conducted into his books. But I think it is an absolutely fantastic place to just go and look, because it's about as close as you can get to the actual events, beside from some primary sources that are collected in different capacities. I think it really is a treasure trove of source material. But let's go ahead and jump into your episodes. I wanted to ask first why you chose to start with First Encounters. If you're right, if you're doing a podcast about Gold Rush, San Francisco, going to the age of exploration with the Spanish might seem to go back a little ways beyond what's relevant for the podcast. So can you explain the kind of rationale for that?
It was a bit accidental. I wanted to go into the Gold Rush, but I knew that I couldn't just jump right into it because people wouldn't have a firm grasp of what that place was like before gold was discovered. And that was important to the story. With all this history, I want to go back as far as I can. I love even like evolutionary history. Like I love going back like that far and incorporating that in some way into these stories. But you can't go back that far. It's just too much time. So I went back as far as I thought was proper. And yeah, so the age of discovery to me was such a fascinating time because that was the first time we were like leaving our pieces of land and going off to new areas. And to me, it's like modern day space exploration. We had no idea what was on these continents. We had no idea what other kinds of people were there or plant life or animals. That's where you get all these myths of giant creatures that come out and kill everyone. Like those were real myths at the time that people believed. And similarly, like the Native Americans, you know, it's like space invaders coming in. Who are these people that look like us that have all this technology? And that whole period, understanding that was, I think, really important to this story because a lot of the Native Americans, particularly in California, they're some of the last to interact with Europeans on the American continent. Even up to the Gold Rush, there are still tribes in the Sierras that hadn't encountered Europeans before. Likely had heard of them, but yeah, still hadn't seen them. Like I was reading accounts of these men, frontiersmen going off in the plains for this mountain man rendezvous in like the early 1830s. And like the first interaction that a lot of these Native Americans had with a European woman and how they were like amazed at her white skin and everyone was coming over to look at her. Understanding that side of this history, like starting with that, because that encounter is still going to be relevant during the Gold Rush when you have all these people coming into California and encountering these Native Americans that are very different than the Plains Indians. And these Native Americans also, particularly in the mountains, encountering these Europeans for the first time in a very combative, violent sort of way.
Yeah. There's been a lot of great work recently in the field of indigenous history, and I've enjoyed many of the books that have been coming out highlighting this, like Pekka Heinolainen's book, Ned Blackhawk's book. There's a new book that just came out by Catherine Duvall. I'm forgetting the name of it. I think you might have it right here, actually. Yeah, Native Nations. And a lot of these books, what they're doing is they're emphasizing indigenous power, because for a long time, there's been this kind of narrative of passivity and victimhood, which only shows you one side of the coin, because we know that there were vast conflicts across the United States with European and indigenous power fighting back and forth. And I guess my question to you is, based on your research, where are you at in this kind of, it seems like it's like a spectrum where you have on one side just overrun by pestilence, diseases, superior weaponry, and then on this other side, you do have this reality that indigenous peoples survived a lot and fought back a lot and had a lot more control than is often suggested in the historical accounts of these periods. So where are you at in terms of the power / passivity pendulum, if you will?
Yeah, I think it really just depends on the different segments. I think the Plains Native Americans, they had an advantage in that, first of all, they're introduced to the horse much sooner than like the California Native Americans were. In the, I think, 1600s, early 1600s, and it began with these Spanish missions. A lot of these Native Americans were trained on the horse by these far northern Spanish missions because they didn't have any settlers to settle these areas and to maintain these large herds of cattle that they were bringing to these missions. And the Spanish government didn't actually want to train the Native Americans. They were worried that they'd become combative. And then after that period, like, these missions, a lot of them would disband. There'd be these revolts. A lot of them would be killed off. This happened over and over again. And so a lot of these Native Americans that were trained on the horse would go into the plains. And then this horse was introduced to the plains Native Americans. It became the centerpiece of their culture. And so they were able to adopt the horse into their culture without having to fully engage with the American army, for instance, right away. It was over a few centuries, they adopted the horse and became very proficient, more so than even like the Europeans that had brought over the horse. It became like a staple of their culture and a part of their survival. And I think the Plains Native Americans in particular, once the Europeans and the Americans started pushing west, had much more resistance than, say, like, you know, the Aztecs and Incans and the Mayans. I think they might have had more resistance had they not been so affected by disease. Because when Cortez goes to conquer the Aztecs, you know, he goes in and then he leaves for a year. And then when he comes back, they're all dying. So there wasn't much of a war except for that initial conflict, which there are a lot of conflicting accounts in that, but that's such a fascinating encounter to me. Yeah, it's different pockets. And then some of these Native Americans, especially ones that didn't have interaction with Europeans until they come in with the gold rush, it's like an invasive species that it's just going to run you over because they don't have the technology. They don't even understand like what's coming. And so I think it was much more difficult for those isolated tribes to resist. But it's such a complicated subject. And I don't think you can say like one way or the other. I think it just depends on which pocket you're talking about.
Yeah, perfect.
All right.
Last question on this kind of first subject of first encounters. Something that when I was doing my research for my early episodes on first encounters on my podcast, something I felt was maybe tangential, definitely related, but not something that I would spend an exorbitant amount of time on, but now in retrospect, wish I would, was really understanding the depth of the political situation in Europe based on the effects that would effects in the colonies. How much time did you try to understand what was going on in Europe in order to understand what was going on in the colonies?
The English colonies or the missions?
The Spanish colonies, the English colonies, the missions.
Yeah. You know, I touched on that. The focus of San Francisco, that was the heart of this story. And then the larger story is the westward expansion. So I didn't touch on it in that much detail. I had a rough understanding of some of those political developments and how they are affecting westward expansion. I found it pretty fascinating. The conquistadors are like nobility, but they weren't the firstborn. So primogeniture was prominent during that period. And if you weren't the firstborn, you weren't getting the family riches. So a lot of these conquistadors were like the second or third sons that were trying to make their fortune. And all of that exploration seemed to be driven by not scientific research, not really even exploration, but it was monetary gain and in particular gold. Of course, that's hugely generalizing, but that seemed to be the driving factor for a lot of these conquistadors. And that inevitably led to all this exploration. But as far as like the political reasoning behind a lot of this stuff, it's so complicated. I tried to get into some of those weeds and I was like, don't even go there. That's just too complicated.
Yeah, no, I think it does seem like it's important to understand the broad strokes, but some of the details, it's a complicated situation. Let's talk about the transition. So in your podcast, you document the transition from Spanish control of Alta California to Mexican control. What were some of the biggest differences that people should understand when they look at this transition?
Yeah. So when Mexico came to power, I look at it all starting from the American Revolution, because that was the first time you had a colony branching off from like this, I call mother country for lack of a better term, the podcast. So before that had happened, no one really believed that was even a potential opportunity. When you have the English colonies branching off from England, which is thought to be the most powerful country in the world, it has this domino effect on a lot of these other colonies. And so Mexico, in the same vein as the English colonies, the Mexican or the Spanish colonies branch off into Mexico and have established a republic similar to the United States, the same, using the United States as an example. But one of the things I didn't realize when I was doing this research and just didn't occur to me was that most of the countries now in South America are descendants of these early Spanish and Portuguese colonies. And they just ended up branching off about the same time Mexico branched off from Spain, which just gives you a perspective of the Spanish influence on the West early on. So the difference between Mexico and Spain was Mexico is only really a country, and it only occupied California for roughly 20 years before you have the Mexican-American War. And it was this country that was just coming into its own, had just been depleted by war, had all this territory it was trying to oversee. The feeling I got was that they were trying to do way too much with too many land and trying to grasp on to these colonies, and particularly in California, which is where I was focusing most of this research on. They really didn't do anything for California. Mexico really wasn't giving California that many resources, but they were taxing them a lot. That naturally creates more and more of a divide. And you have the Californians believing that they should rule themselves. So this divide, I feel like that leads to the breaking off of California to the United States. But that natural divide between California and Mexico, I feel like that was the instigator of it all, because they didn't pay any attention to California. California didn't feel like they had much alliance to Mexico. And by the time you have all these foreigners coming to California and realizing what it is, California, it seems, is trying to find the best suitor to take them over. And I think they weren't too happy when the Americans took them over. There's all these rumors that the English were going to take them over because they had given Mexico all this money to help in the war against Spain. That also sped up the American takeover because they're worried that England might come and take California. And at the time, there's this joint possession of Oregon that the Americans are worried about with England. And so they thought that if England takes California, they're going to have this new foothold to take Oregon as well. So there's all this confusion and worry and desire by all these other countries to take California. When these captains would go into California, realize that Mexico really wasn't building up their colonies there. It was just left for the taking. One of the sailors described California as a ripe apple ready to be plucked from the tree by whichever country comes by first. And so when you have that feeling by all these powerful countries, it's this fight to take it first without creating this swarm of global political upheaval.
One of the things I really enjoyed, I think it's your most previous episode where you talk about ranchero culture, Dons. That's something I didn't really cover a whole lot at the emergence of some of the ideas we have around cowboys or vaqueros. Can you talk about some interesting things that you learned about that culture? And do you think it still has some legacies in modern day California and the Central Valley and different places?
Yeah, that culture, that was so fascinating to me, because you had this like myth of the American cowboy being like a part of our culture from the very beginning. And so it was really interesting to me to learn that it really originated with these northern territories and Mexico, at least these like large range cattle ranches that we are familiar with today in the United States. So in terms of their relation to Northern California today, I can't really speak to that too much. I don't know enough about modern Northern California ranches, more in the Wyoming territory. I've done a lot of research in that, but America does have the largest ranches by far in the world today, largest cattle ranches by far in the world. Over half of our land in the continental U.S. is designated for range pasture farming. And so it's really striking just how much of our land is used for these enormous farms and particular cattle ranches, that those cattle dominates most of our pasture land. And these enormous range cattle ranches really originated with these missions in Northern California. And that's the first vaqueros, the first cowboys in the United States were really these, not only these Spanish settlers, but also these Native Americans they brought in and trained in the horse. So it was really interesting to me to think, oh, okay, because you have this natural, cowboys and Indians were in media are thought to be natural enemies, you know what I mean? And then to go back and look at the actual history and to figure out that the first cowboys were really Native Americans, and they weren't from the United States at all. You didn't have these large range cattle ranches until the United States started moving across the country and by land. And that was really fascinating to me. And then also that horses didn't exist in California until the Portola expedition. While you have the Plains Native Americans being introduced to the horse in the early 1600s by the Spanish and their territories in Texas and New Mexico, and California was much later, and cattle as well. So that to me was interesting because for a number of reasons, but one of which was the cattle ranches in California were thought to be the largest that the Spanish had. And those were the ones that were the easiest to protect because you have the California mountain ranges protecting from the Plains Native Americans as a buffer. And then you also had the, you know, if you're familiar with the California coast, you have these high coastal walls, and then you have these small mountain range in between the Central Valley and the Sierras. And so it was this kind of naturally protected area. So you could have these enormous cattle ranches, and that really allowed them to be built up versus the cattle ranches in like New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, where the Native Americans and Plains, once they begin to master the horse, would begin to come in and raid these cattle ranches. And so you have these missions that were built up, and then they'd be raided, everyone would be killed, and they'd be disbanded, and they take their cattle and horses away. And so you didn't have the enormous ranches that you did in California. So that was interesting to me. Just understanding that whole evolution was, I don't know, really fascinating. And the fact that the plains at the time was like this unknown desert, like no one really went in there. Like even in the 1800s, like you had these trappers and traders that went in there, but they numbered, and it's thought to be around 1,000 like proper American trappers total. And so like that whole area was unknown to people for until really gold was discovered, and you have all these people mapping out. Fremont was a part of that mapping, first of a few mapping expeditions, but there are, I think, two government funded expeditions after Lewis and Clark into the interior up until Fremont's expeditions in the early 1830s. So no one knew it was out there. And then you have these plains tribes evolving with the horse, and their cultures evolving with the horse, unknown to the United States at the time. So you have these cultures like adopting the horse into their culture, mastering the horse, becoming these warrior tribes, and becoming very formidable in isolation. No one really realizes that they're building up their strength. And then when the United States finally comes into the plains, like they're meeting this incredibly formidable force that has become like a warrior culture by that point. So that whole evolution, I want to go into that in more detail, but yeah, episode three, I cover it in broad strokes just to get an idea of how that affected California and the Western expansion.
So I know you're just a few episodes in, but where do you see this podcast project going? Where do you envision it a few years from now? What will you have covered?
Yeah, the episodes take a long time. I hope to finish out this season by the end of the year. So I have three more episodes to go in this season. So it's pre-Gold Rush, San Francisco, and California history. This is all kind of a foundational season, if you will. And the next season, I want to look in detail at the Gold Rush, because that was really where most of my research was before I really dove into this. So that's the goal. And initially, I wanted to do a podcast per month, and they take much longer than I thought, as you probably know as well. Yeah. So especially if you're doing this like deep chronological history. So we'll see if I continue in the chronological type of episodes in the next season. The Gold Rush, there's so much to cover in that as well. And what I've learned is as the period I cover shortens, like the amount of years each episode covers shortens, the episodes and the research tends to get longer because you're zoomed in much more. You're focused on a lot more specifics. So it just gets more difficult to really understand all these different perspectives when you're focused on individual people and what their lives are like and individual interactions versus this culture migrated here at this time and the horse is introduced at this time. Yeah, it's getting more complicated as I go along, but that's the goal. And this all supplements a book project that I've been working on And that's how this whole podcast came about, because I was doing this research for a book that covers some of these early trappers that come into California just before the gold rush. And one trapper in particular, I'm following his evolution, and he just takes over all these Native American tribes and becomes the chief of all these different tribes of thousands of Native Americans, and ends up using them to mine for gold. And so all this research really supplements that book project. So yeah, hope to get to through the gold rush next season. And then this book project I hope to complete hopefully within the next year.
So I ask a lot of people that I bring on the show this question because I like them to reflect on how ideas have changed. So before you started this research process and now where you are in it, how has your perspective on California history changed?
Really just, I didn't, like, even when I lived there, I didn't look at the history in that much depth. You see all the names on all the streets, and you hear that there was a place called Yerba Buena in San Francisco that was San Francisco before it became San Francisco. And then once you dig in and do the research, you realize like all these streets were named after these men who came during this pre-gold rush period. It has this whole Mexican and Spanish heritage. It really was like a port at the edge of the world for hundreds of years, really undeveloped and really unexplored. And to me, the thing that's so crazy is it's been in under 200 years. You have San Francisco that went from a town that was around 200 to 250 people before gold's discovery to now one of the most populated cities in our country. And all that area is developed around it. The Central Valley, which was thought of as this Garden of Eden by all these explorers, even like through the gold rush was still this complete wilderness, is now completely developed. I think it produces like 30% of American produce, something like that. Don't quote me on that, but an enormous percentage of our produce. And just how not that long ago, it was this wilderness that people couldn't get to except for by ship. It was protected by these mountain ranges, and no one was really crossing the continent to get there. And then when it was discovered and first settled by Europeans during the gold rush, it was all these different cultures coming from all these different parts of the world that had no conception of what the other was like. Because it wasn't just Americans coming with the gold rush. The first people over there were from like South America, because that was the easiest accessible point from ships. And so having lived in California and seeing the melting pot of different cultures and people that are there now, and going back and doing this research and seeing how it all started, and the melting pot and violence that involved when you have these people first coming over there, and how it's like waves coming together. It's this crash, this craziness, and then it all settles down. That was really fascinating for me to see, because you can see it connected. You can see San Francisco today connected to that history. And it gives you a better appreciation for it. And I don't know. I look at all places like that now. Like everywhere I go, I'm like, why is it the way it is now? What was here before? The streets that were here are probably here from like horses and buggies, and might not be the best for cars, but that's how these street grids originated. You know what I mean? Things like that. So yeah. What about you? Had you done this history?
Yeah, I think it is challenging at this point to really encapsulate all the things that I've learned, just because I've been on this journey for such a long time. I think the non-linearity of history, I think, is a big one. I think there's a lot of big principles that I take from it, and how contingent history is, how an accident or a choice can lead to a different set of outcomes. I think this is true for a lot of people. Yeah. The more you learn about something, the less you feel like. And so I probably developed a strong sense of epistemological humility in doing this podcast and understanding how different some of these stories are. I think when you look at history, it's a helpful way of deconstructing myths that you were given, whether in school or outside of it. Yeah. So I think there's a lot there. It'd be tough for me to encapsulate it, but I think those are the broad strokes of how my perspective has been informed and changed in some ways.
I think to your point, like one of the biggest things is how it's everything in the past is connected to the present, even like a sneeze or a stub in the toe. John Muir, who's one of his famous quotes, is you pick out anything by itself, you find it hitched to everything in the universe. And like seeing some of these small events in California and the grand effects of them really makes you appreciate, oh, this one conversation really affected like a whole city and culture and really like the world afterwards. And the only reason we know about it is because it's well documented. And there's so many little things like that throughout the world of these events we haven't even seen or don't really fully understand that really impacted everything that came after. And really everything in the past affected everything after. It's just we can't connect all of it. So I think that's the biggest thing for me too.
Yeah, I think there's smaller things like understanding now that in terms of indigenous population, California was one of the most densest parts of the United States in terms of indigenous people living in California, how diverse it was, how the fact that it was so, there were so many different geographical pockets of indigenous people that they, that kept them separated. So it became easier to conquer in some ways versus consolidated power. There's so much there and we could dig into that more, but I want to end with book recommendations. This is my favorite part of every podcast. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
So I named one, which is The New World with David Roberts. Really fascinating account of Fremont and Kit Carson. So it goes into detail of their journey westward. The Barbary Coast. Have you read that?
Yes, that's an incredible book.
Yeah. Yeah, great book. If you ever watched the movie Gangs of New York, Barbary Coast is by the same author as the gangs in San Francisco. And a lot of the characters that are in Gangs of New York end up in San Francisco, the real guys. In terms of like deep San Francisco or California history, there's one account that I really like called The Other Californians. You heard of that book? Mm-hmm. And that it was a great resource for a lot of this research just because it has all these accounts of the Presidio soldiers fighting these wild Native Americans and firsthand accounts of either these soldiers or ship captains going into the interior and seeing what it was like for these Presidio soldiers and these missions to try to bring in these Native Americans and the violence that was surrounding it. I won't get into more detail than that, but it's pretty rough stuff. And then John of the Mountains. If you like John Muir, John of the Mountains is his unpublished journals. And there's some really fascinating accounts of his first journeys into California that you won't find in any of his published works. I have some more. I don't know if you want me to go.
Yeah, keep going. Keep going. Give us a few more.
Empire of the Summer Moon. That's another classic. Gwyn really paints a picture of the Comanches and the plains and how remote it was at the time and how formidable the horse tribes were. And then Blood Meridian. Cormac McCarthy is a great one if you want to understand. I feel like we tend to romanticize the Gold Rush period, at least had traditionally. Now you have more works coming out that are really shining a light on how destructive that period was. But Blood Meridian, Cormac McCarthy, was based off a lot of firsthand accounts and it focuses on Texas, the violence in Texas in 1849. But man, if you want to get a visceral feel of what that violence might have been like, Blood Meridian is a great one. And then one that might seem odd considering the subject matter, but I think is really a really interesting read after you understand this history, Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck, because Steinbeck too, he was a reporter first. And so he was following all these people that were engaged in the Dust Bowl. And if you're not familiar with Grapes of Wrath, it follows the Dust Bowl. But that the difficulties of all the settlers going into California at the time and trying to work on all these farms, it's the next story after the Gold Rush of what happens in California when we had all these men come in for these land grabs, take over these large areas of farming, and then you have all these settlers come in, and it's a perpetuation of this persecution of the lower culture. So I recommend reading that after you learn a little bit about California's early history, and it'll be a much more interesting read.
That's fantastic. Langdon, thanks for coming on. Right now, I think we have 3 episodes. When are we expecting a 4th? And we can find your podcast, Savas West, on Apple, Spotify, all the usual places, correct?
All the places, yeah. Hopefully the next episode will be out shortly. I've been trying to record it in the last few weeks. This one has been tough because it's more detailed. So I'm hoping to get it out by the end of this week, but we'll see. I said that last week and the week before. But yeah, hopefully it comes out soon. Before we finish too, man, I just want to say thank you for inviting me on. This is my first interview after the podcast. So appreciate you having me on and talking about, I love talking about this stuff. So hopefully that was engaging for listeners. Yeah. And looking forward to discussing this stuff more with you in the future.
Appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. As always, you can support us by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. Thank you.